Welcome to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. All right, well, you know my favorite topic and my friend Bill Smith's favorite topic. Bill is the chef at Crook's Corner, and he says that there are two guys who live in Charleston, South Carolina, who are in the wholesale catalog, basically boiled peanut business, but who also write for the New York Times and have written a fantastic Southern cookbook. And Bill, you and I have got Matt Lee and Ted Lee here in the studio to talk to us about their brand new cookbook.
Welcome. We do.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good
Matt,
to be here.
Good to be here.
Bill, I don't want to push you, but when I told you they were coming, you said, I know these guys, and they're great. How'd you get to know them?
Mainly, I guess, through Southern Foodways Alliance, yes?
Yep.
I don't even remember now. But you also know my friend Catherine Walton, I think, who's my agent and mentor and, and prod and
taskmaster.
Yes, exactly. Taskmaster. That's the word I was looking for. Yeah, exactly so.
Well, also about cooking, Bill, introduce us in terms of you're into fresh stuff right out of the field and
pick it myself.
Pick it yourself, kind of thing. These guys are into real old-time Southern cooking. They're waving our flag in all around the country.
They are.
If you want to tell us, Matt and Ted, how you all got into this.
Well, we got into it because we were, ironically enough, in New York after college, trying to find sort of in dead-end jobs in New York, and we were super homesick for Charleston, where we grew up. And we were specifically homesick for boiled peanuts. And so,
just to say that you're, you know, Eastern North Carolina, South Carolina, if my wife grew up in Horry County.
Right.
And if you, it sets you apart, doesn't it, if you like boiled peanuts?
It does. It does, in a way. And in New York, especially, because no one's heard of boiled peanuts. So we were homesick for them from our own perspective, and so we went out and bought some. We found raw peanuts.
We didn't buy boiled peanuts because we couldn't find them, but we figured out how to locate the raw peanuts that you need for boiling, and they were at this, you know, hellacious wholesale fruit and vegetable market in the Bronx, and you have to enter through like a barbed wire fence and everything, and it's only open at certain hours, and brought them back to the apartment and just started boiling. But
Did y'all boil them growing up, or were you having to? Did you have to get a reference?
Yes.
So you did it, and did you grow up on a farm in Charleson?
No,
you
no, no. Very citified.
Peanuts, or did you buy them on the corner?
You may have noticed that the subtitle of our book, the Lee Brothers Southern Cookbook, is stories and recipes for Southerners and would-be Southerners, which is a bit of a mouthful. But ironically enough, we were born in New York City.
Oh.
And we moved to Charleston when I was 8 and Matt was 10, and we just fell. I mean, at that time, when you
right downtown, right on East Bay Street. So, you know, townhome. It felt familiar. You know, it was a walkable New York sort of situation.
Y'all don't talk funny, and so I
no right
in Charleston
or not funny
Charleston.
Enough.
we always, go down to the Battery, and you just right, yeah. Anyway. You learned to talk in New York, and then
we learned to talk in New York, and then we learned how to eat and how to cook in Charleston. And that was, you know, that we really did learn how to cook. And we, you know, going to Charleston, moving to Charleston from New York City when you're 8 years old, there's a ton of culture shock that you go through. But to us, the coolest thing about the new, you know, our new home in Charleston was, you know, the different foods and the different ways you sourced it. You know, suddenly I had friends who hunted and fished and gigged for flounder.
All this at 8 and 10 years old? You guys were thinking about this? Now, why were you into cooking so young?
I mean, I think in retrospect, it comes out more. But there are a couple reasons why. And one is that my uncle's a restaurateur. And he was always, you know, he was always my crazy Uncle John.
Our mother's younger brother, who was always the naughty one, he fell on the other side of that 1960s divide, and Mom was on the 1950s side of it. And so there's this tension between the two of them that's, you know, just fascinating for us. And of course,
your uncle more than your mama.
Straight to Toronto to hang out with Uncle John. Yeah,
but it was cool too how in Charleston, you know, people just went shrimping and crabbing, and the kids, you know. The kids were doing it just for sport, and then they'd, you know, give the crabs to their mom, and she'd make crab dip or, you know, steam up the shrimp. So for us, it started out being more just, oh, this is a cool sport, you know, like fishing. with a dividend, you know, like with. But, you know, we'd never. I was into skateboarding at the time when we moved down there. Matt was into baseball. And so when you suddenly switch to something where you're actually, like, fishing for something that you bring back, it's, you know, it's really cool. And that we never sort of got over that.
Well, now, even in the city of Charleston, the kids go out in boats and find places to shrimp.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, the city's just surrounded by water. And right, I mean, we're in the heart of the, we were in the heart of the city, right on East Bay Street, looking out at the pilot boat dock. And, you know, friends would drag us down to the pilot boat dock just 200 yards from the house and drop chicken necks in the water. And we'd have a long-handled net and we'd scoop up crabs. And that was sport. You know, that was just a fun afternoon. And, or, you know, you've seen one of those cast nets, you know, long cast net, and you put part of it in your teeth and you toss it out there and catch, you know, bait, essentially. But you also catch shrimp. And, you know, you're thinking in the back of your mind, wow, shrimp are $20 a pound in New York City. You know, that's sort of cool. It's like digging for truffles or something.
Bill Smith, you grew up on the water, too.
I did. And when I was reading their introduction, actually, there was a part where you mentioned the smell of the marsh.
Yeah, plus the smell of the low tide.
And I was just down there lately. My brother was here from California with a friend of his, and my brother and one of my sisters and I were driving to the coast to show this guy our beaches. And as soon as we hit that place where you smell that sulfur, we all went, oh, man. And he looked at us like, that smells like...
You know. Sewage.
Yeah, and we all go, oh, yeah, we're home, sort of. And
yeah.
Going, ooh.
No. When we, I mean, it's always funny when you get into South Carolina driving down I-95 and suddenly you hit the smell of the paper factory.
Oh, right.
You know,
yes,
which
exactly.
Is sort of
it's sort of the same. It is, actually.
Sort of the same different thing.
Different sulfur.
And you're just like, oh, I'm home. And, you know, if you've got someone else in the car, they're like, oh, that's not pleasant.
What's going on here?
Well, tell us about Southern cooking. Let me just ask you a couple of questions that and Bill and Matt and Ted, Bill Smith and Matt and Ted Lee are here educating me about Southern cooking. And y'all are all interested in collards, and we're moving towards the cold season. So how you've got a section about cooking collards, and Bill, you know, you've sold us on eating collards as well. What's the secret of good collard cooking?
That's a good question. I think the secret to good collard cooking is like a great slab bacon.
Or a good seasoning meat.
Yeah. Good seasoning enough meat, salt. Like a great pig's foot. Enough salt.
Vinegar helps, too.
Vinegar. I cook in a little vinegar, and I a little bit of sugar. Not so much, but a tiny bit just to... I think it takes the bitterness out of the greens themselves. But I also think that there are so many different ways to cook collard greens. I'd be curious to know how Bill does them, because I tend toward, you know, there seems to be this divide between the ancients and the moderns. And the ancients say, oh, you got to slow simmer your greens, put them on the back of the stove.
Smell like your house,
yeah, like
for sure.
All day. Yeah.
No shorter than
and
8 hours.
Like my friend Tom, who lives on Sullivan's Island, South Carolina, he's like, oh, collards in a skillet, you know, you just flash saute them in olive oil and lemon juice, and you know, 5 minutes, 6 minutes.
But he has
fine, you know.
Tom has the luxury of picking them out of his John's Island garden and selecting for the leaves, you know, closest to the head, you know, the tenderest leaves.
So you're pulling up the whole plant,
right?
Selling
right.
For $2,
right?
Or whatever.
So he gets to pick and choose. So his are super tender, and he cuts them real fine. But I'd be curious to know how, Bill, you do your collards.
Well, we boil them longer than that. So I'm suspicious of 2-minute collards, really, I think.
Yeah.
But I've not had them, so I don't know. But the thing about our collards is that they've passed through Mexico now, because all my day prep people are from Mexico, and they're getting hotter and hotter.
And hotter.
And I like it. I think it's like a tonic.
Yeah.
But we cook them medium. I don't like them cooked to mush, but I do like them boiled a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And we always put bacon or ham bone or whatever we have in it. So.
Well, Matt and Ted, in your book, you talked about an interesting concept for me, which was whether or not throwing the slab of bacon in, or the vinegar,
right,
or whatever, or the Mexican seasoning that
right.
Bill Smith
Pepper
is going to deal with, whether all of that is designed to draw out the flavor of the collards, or you didn't say this, but I was wondering, or are they really doing this to cover up the flavor of the collard?
Oh, no, I think they just enhance the flavor. To me, the you know, I when I'm when I'm washing my collards, it's so hard for me not to be eating them. To me, they taste like, you know,
eating
like,
them raw.
Yeah, eating them raw. They taste like broccoli. It's so great. I mean,
the tiny little leaves at the heart are totally edible.
But I just love the flavor of collards. I've always loved the flavor.
It's a strong enough flavor that you can play around with it. I mean, if we were talking about spinach greens or, you know, anything more timid, you really wouldn't be able to load on the pepper. But the great thing about collard greens is that you can add flavors from different directions and still have it be in a balance that makes sense and where people can perceive every element there. But, you know, they are strongly flavored.
Well, Bill Smith and I are Bill Smith, the chef at Crook's Corner, and our sponsor. We're grateful for that. And I are talking to two friends of his, the Lee brothers, Matt and Ted, whose new cookbook, the Lee Brothers Southern Cookbook, is hitting the shelves as we speak, and we'll be back to talk to them after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bill Smith, the chef at Crook's Corner, and I are visiting with two of his friends, Matt Lee and Ted Lee. These guys grew up in Charleston, but you told us the story of going up to New York and getting homesick and cooking boiled peanuts, and that led. Tell us about the business that you guys are in.
Well, it didn't, you know, it started out as us just cooking peanuts for ourselves, and then we thought, you know, we should really share boiled peanuts with the big city. And, you know, at the time, there were a lot of Southern restaurants in New York, and we thought, you know, we would start with the Southern restaurants, sell boiled peanuts to them, and suddenly it would all catch on. It would be the hip bar snack. Like, everywhere you went, you'd have a bowl of boiled peanuts on the bar.
We got some stars in our eyes. We thought, you know, boiled peanuts are so popular down in the low country, and everyone knows them. 100% of people know what they are, even if they hate them. And a lot of people do hate them, but that's good. But anyhow,
you know,
so...
That gives you something to talk
about.
We
thought, let's, you know, if they don't exist in New York, let's make them a phenomenon here. Why not? Why wouldn't they be?
Right.
And so we printed up business cards that said, you know, Lee Brothers Boiled Peanuts, the snack of the 90s, which in retrospect seems hilarious.
We just went cold calling on restaurant doors, and what we found out, because we... you know, we would walk into a Southern restaurant and we'd say, you know, we got these things. And they'd say, wait, is there a hidden camera here? What's going on? You know, that's wet. I'm not touching that. And what you found was that the Southern restaurants were not owned by Southerners. And, you know, they often were owned by people who'd never been to the South, or, you know, maybe they'd been to New Orleans or to, you know, Memphis.
They were fakes.
But, yeah, they were basically, you know, doing a pastiche of Southern, whatever, but they didn't.
I mean, you would go to a Japanese restaurant, and there are no Japanese.
Right.
There are Koreans and Malaysians Mexicans. Yeah.
So we decided that it would just be a whole lot easier, a whole lot better for everyone if we just sold them to people like us who had already been sold on them, who were expatriate Southerners.
Not be an evangelist, but be serving.
Yeah,
the
right. We didn't have to do the whole spiel to explain to them what they were. And we thought, well, mail order is the way to go with that if you want to collect a mass of people scattered around the country into one operative business unit. And we just floated a letter to the New York Times, and it was, you know, boiled peanuts now available by mail order. And she ran with it, boiled peanuts now available by mail order. And
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I thought the funniest part of that story was she hated them.
That's right. Yeah, she called in a sample.
She called in a sample. You know, we had sent her a press release, and she called in a sample. And so we dropped it off at her house, and she called back. She said, I have good news and bad news. Bad news is I hate them. Good news is I have a friend from Virginia who explained them to me, and she tried them, and she loved them, and she said they were the real thing, so I'm going to write about you.
How do you, when you sell, you know, we know how to get boiled peanuts off the stands and the road, but I'm curious about, first of all, how you sell them by mail order, and then what were you thinking about when you took them to a restaurant? How are they going to serve them?
We were thinking at the restaurant that they'd have them as a bar snack, and that, you know, what bar could resist? They don't cost a lot. They're salty. They generate more drink sales, presumably. But they also generate some wet, soggy shells and wet fingers, so they probably consume a lot of napkins. But by mail order, the way to do it is to post a high minimum. 5 pounds is the minimum order you can get. So you got a nice big chunk of them. You chill them down. They're perishable, just, you know, sort of the way a carton of orange juice is. Not extremely perishable, but... They need to be kept chilly all the way. And you chill them down just above freezing. You insulate them in styrofoam. You send them out FedEx. And you spend a fortune, fortune on shipping. Well, you can do them
so
second,
send a dollar and product, and it costs $45 to send there.
Exactly.
But DG, by the time that you've ordered our peanuts, you've basically spent $10 a pound on boiled peanuts.
Well,
so you have to want them really, really bad.
This is way off topic, but I went. We don't have a lot of the peanuts here, but I went to Eastern North Carolina a couple of weeks ago. This is to William Ivy Long's hometown in Seaboard.
Oh yeah,
And sitting in the, you know, great home cooking cafeteria cafe in Seaboard, the farmer accosted me and told me, I ain't growing peanuts anymore. You know, Northeastern North Carolina is out of the peanut business. We're out of it because the foreign competition, you know.
That's interesting.
That they can grow them out of the country or somewhere else, so much cheaper than we can grow them, that although Northeastern North Carolina, that was the main cash crop.
Mm-hmm. Really?
They are back into cotton and now into corn and all of stuff like that. So when I read about this, I wondered where you guys get your supply.
New Mexico.
I'll tell you a funny story.
No, but the great thing about for North Carolina and South Carolina is as people become more familiar with fresh, out-of-the-ground, green peanuts, like that will give them an advantage. The problem is now that 99% of all peanuts are roasted and sent straight to the roaster, and this whole boiled peanuts thing is a very minor,
a niche market,
tiny slice, and even the peanut board isn't quite even aware of the fresh peanut market. But as we talk more about it and as we get people more interested in that fascinating, bizarre, bean-like taste of, you know, a raw peanut, I think that there's a lot of potential there to give local peanut growers an advantage over their Asian counterparts.
Well, would you, if you were, when I bet you all came up with 1,000 different sales pitches.
You know, well, a couple.
I mean, my experience of eating peanuts wet and slimy is that it's like a vegetable oyster. You know, you just have to.
It's definitely.
And then it's
funny you should mention that because one of our slogans in the early days was the oyster of snacks. Because you sort of shucked it, you slurped it down, and then you sipped
the brine
out of the shell. You know,
dribbled down your fingers.
And, it didn't quite take though.
Well, I could have been in there failing with you.
Yeah,
you could have been because
there.
That would have been. I want you, Bill. Well, you say whatever you want to, but I'm real curious about why you don't have boiled peanuts.
We have actually talked about it, actually. It comes up periodically. And I think it's the mess factor.
Yeah,
because they say, we ought to put boiled peanuts on the bar. And I say, okay. And then I never hear anything more about it because I think Gene's reconsidered that maybe.
And then some people who don't know about boiled peanuts will say, well, why don't you just shell them and put out a bowl of already shelled peanuts, and that would take care of the mess factor.
But that's worse.
There's something that I mean, there's something about
the
already shelled peanut.
Hold the flavor.
It's a preservative. It's got a lot of tannins in it.
A little bit though, sometimes, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, there's nothing standing in the way of doing that. Just for those of us who grew up with them, it doesn't. You know, the shelling it and the slurping it down is sort of part of the whole production.
I'm so excited about this, but is there a line that goes, say, roughly down I-95 where on one side of it you have roasted peanuts and on the other is boiled peanuts?
It's much more complicated than that. I mean, there are pockets of, you know, peanut awareness, and I think, I mean, you got to find which counties have a peanut extension agent and, like, do about 50 miles outside that county and you've pretty much got it covered. I'd love to see that map, and I'm sure we could generate it, but it's hit or miss. There's some people down in Alabama, northern Florida. I think the epicenter, just for my 14 years in the business, is somewhere in Georgia or near the Georgia-South Carolina state line. Like, that's where the heart of boiled peanut awareness and love, and as you get further away from that epicenter, it sort of trickles out.
There is this sort of badge of camaraderie that distinguishes Southerners proudly, stupidly, I might say, in some cases, about the things that we do together that our Northern friends just simply won't. You know, chitlins used to be one, but younger people are not always into chitlins. That's not your favorite.
Not my favorite.
Collards is another.
Yeah.
Grits?
Certainly grits.
Hominy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are the other? And of course, boiled peanuts.
Liver pudding.
Liver pudding. Yeah. Liver mush.
Right. Yeah.
There, and down in, you guys, we've been talking about Fuller's down in Wilson County off of I-95, where we've had some great culinary experiences. And a little bit further to the west of there, over in Pembroke itself, they have a wonderful fish camp. And what they eat are the kinds of fish that were popular in the Depression because they were so cheap.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And people... It was a badge of we were in poverty.
Right.
Now we'll pay, $14.95 for fried fish.
Right.
Some of these dishes that are the badge of Southern cooking just came out of a real poor farm depression experience.
Well, I was told that oxtails are another thing like that. Like someone said, and Bill, maybe you'd know more, that they used to be super cheap.
I think they were. Yeah.
Now they're sort of like a premium product.
Oh, well, another thing you guys are famous for is describing the chicken wing business.
where it's like the chicken wing.
We used to throw it away.
What happened? Now it's more expensive than chicken breasts.
Bill, these guys are the expert on chicken wings.
I did not know that.
Well, they are the experts on why chicken wings.
We did write a story about chicken wings.
Instead of a regular 19 cents a pound, which is where they ought to be, you now have to pay more for chicken wings than you do for breast meat. Why chicken?
I heard somebody complaining. Where was I the other day? Somebody was berating the waitress because there weren't boneless chicken wings for them. And I didn't know those existed.
I didn't either.
Well, apparently it's a lot more easy to eat them, as I was told.
It's compressed.
I don't know what they are, but you don't
mold.
Bother with that troublesome bone.
I don't know.
I'm so sorry. I should be keeping my mouth shut because y'all have so many stories. But I was eating in one of my favorite restaurants. It wasn't yours, in Chapel Hill. And I got so excited because they had fried chicken and mashed potatoes. Uh-huh. I couldn't believe it. Fried chicken, mashed potatoes, and maybe or some kind of vegetable. Mm-hmm. And so I said, "Oh man, that's great. That's what I want, and I want dark meat." And so the waitress came back and she said, "The chef said we can't guarantee what you'll get." I thought, "My golly, have they got it? Compacted and packaged in which case I do not want it." Upon further inquiry, I got my usual old man livid self and cranky and said, "I want to talk to the chef."
What is the world coming to when you can't get a good chicken thigh? Better than a chicken thigh.
It turned out that they don't, that it wasn't any confusion about it. It wasn't that they couldn't guarantee it. It wasn't. It was that they did not have dark.
Right. They'd sold out.
But having got us off the track, getting back to the track about chicken wings.
Yeah.
Why do chicken wings cost so much?
Well, here's the deal is that you can't, let's say the world wants 1,000 chicken breasts. You've only got 2,000 chicken wings. And so if the balance between the desire for chicken breasts and chicken wings gets out of balance and suddenly, people are throwing 10 parties, they need 5,000 chicken wings, they can't produce them without. And so it's this weird business. It's, I guess, like any other, meat producing, cow or pig business, but it's even more intense because, the bird is so small and the value is so small per animal. But anyhow, it's just a supply and demand thing. And these chains have popularized them just in the last, it was the early 70s that the first
buffalo wing was
invented. And it's just a wild story of how a regional food can spread around the country. And, that's one of the things that gives me hope about Southern food is that I feel that it's such a strength. Like, we really could spread it around the country if we just talk about it enough and convince people.
Yeah, we think that Southern cuisine could become the American cuisine.
And it should.
Well, we're going way past break time. I'm Bill Smith, the chef at Crook's Corner, and I are talking to Matt Lee and Ted Lee, who are the authors and compilers of the Lee Brothers Southern Cookbook. And they've been telling us about their peanut business. Maybe we can get them to talk some more about the cookbook when we return after the short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. My buddy Bill Smith and I are talking to two heroes of the Southern cooking movement. Is that fair to say? I mean, you guys have this.
That is overstatement.
No, but y'all have this. This is like a church. And y'all have camp meeting once a year down in Oxford or somewhere with a
We had chicken thighs down there, too, now that you mention it. Yeah.
And the rest of us kind of, those guys who go there, we worship you because you all come back knowing how to do this.
Well, y'all are invited. Nowadays, you have to win the lottery to get, and there's a waiting list to get in on there.
It's gotten so big, yeah.
But well, how did the, Matt and Ted started out in the boiled peanut business, and that's a story in itself. We could talk about that all day, but another interesting story must be how in the world the boiled peanut mail order business led to, you know, distinction as cooks and as cookbook writers and writers for the New York Times and for Martha Stewart. And
well, there was a lot of luck involved in making the transition from being boiled peanut sellers to food writers, and that was actually because a customer of ours for the catalog, you know, one of the catalog customers called us out of the blue and said, I've been reading your catalog. I love the little catalog entries you've got. I think you could do a great story for us about traveling upstate South Carolina and, you know, checking in with your suppliers, hitting some barbecue stands, and
telling the story of the catalog. And she was the editor-in-chief of Travel and Leisure magazine.
Wow. So, and she's one of your customers.
She's a customer. So we didn't really even know it.
Big break.
Well, but you earned it. I mean, you were ready. I mean, yeah, you were ready.
Well, we were ready for it.
And then after that,
you were prepared for
prepared.
It.
So we went out on the road, you know, got paid to do it, eat, drink, you know, do what we do, and we're like, dang, we've got to do this more often. I mean,
this is a good gig.
This is a good gig, and it's a good compliment to the catalog. And so we pitched a story on Northern Florida, traveling Northern Florida.
So but in your article in Traveling Leisure, you're able to have a little thing at the bottom which said these guys are in the boiled peanut business.
We told the whole story of starting the business and our sort of unusual relationship to Southern food and you know, for a national audience, you have to do a lot of explaining what the boiled peanuts are. Anyhow, we got through it and had a wild time in upstate South Carolina, the part they don't normally cover in a magazine like Travel and Leisure. So Clemson Blue Cheese was in there and Newberry.
Blue Cheese. I just want you to know my wife and just had the biggest fight because I love Clemson Blue Cheese. And it comes from her family, and she doesn't. So we have this battle about if I leave it in the refrigerator, it's gone. Would you help me tell her?
Oh, we can help. I mean, it's got a great history and everything.
It's so great.
And you can order it. Can you order it through your catalog?
You can't. It's, in fact, too perishable for us to get involved
in
that.
Even more perishable than boiled peanuts?
Oh, yeah. Cheese is, you know, difficult to ship, to say the least. But so we got so excited about this road tripping, dining, talking about it, writing about it thing that we started pitching stories to Food and Wine magazine and to the New York Times, Martha Stewart Living eventually. And they started asking us to develop, you know, home cooking recipes that involved us getting into the kitchen, you know, with no culinary training.
So peanuts to travel around food in your area as a kind of complement to your developing the business.
Right, exactly.
From there to more food and from writing more about writing food into doing the recipes.
That's right.
What a dream. I mean, Bill, cool. Can you believe this?
And then, sounds great. I mean, segueing from like writing about Southern recipes to writing about Spanish recipes and, you know, you sort of start the conversation one direction and you just flow along and suddenly you're
follow wherever it
doing
takes.
The wine column for Martha Stewart Living magazine every month.
Wow. Well,
sort of bizarre.
When you guys were 8 and 10 years old and you moved to Charleston, you weren't into wine at that point. Had you gotten...
No. Well,
you might have been.
Our parents let us have a sip, later in high school.
We actually learned to cook pretty early because my mom... like 3 years after we moved to Charleston, my mom started commuting back to New York for work.
Our mom, not our just mom. His mom. It's not like we had different moms.
But I always say that.
Probably y'all came out in the same place.
Our mother started commuting back to New York, and you know, by that time, Matt had his learner's permit, and he could go do the food shopping. And my dad worked full-time, too. And so we basically learned to cook with my dad over the phone from work saying, now, there's a pound of shrimp in the refrigerator. You got to peel it, and then you got to get a pot of rice on the stove, and it was just sort of like you learn a lot as a kid.
You burn your first pot of rice, and you know you've learned that lesson. You can move on.
To be able to do that, to be able to
he's a liver doctor.
Is he?
Yes.
He's intrepid.
And a scientist. He does research and stuff like that. So he was willing to set us loose in the kitchen.
He's a good educator. So
yeah, but what a great story. I wonder how most of the brothers that I know love each other, but they could not. I mean, they might be able to work together in an ordinary business if they're on two different sides of the factory or something. But what about writing together? How did that develop, and how does it work? How do you keep from killing each other?
Well, we shared a bedroom growing up the whole time, and then you know, as you enter adolescence and you're 2 years apart, I'm Matt, I'm the older one, those differences, that 2 years seems huge, and we became very different people, and Ted was into skateboarding and getting in trouble and throwing water balloons at tourists, and I was into the Rocket Club and role-playing games
and
the computer, which in the early 80s seemed sort of esoteric and geeky, and I'm grateful to see that everyone's caught up with me. But so anyhow, we're that different, and we went off to college, different colleges. And
where did y'all go to school, by the way?
I went to Amherst College in Amherst, Massachusetts.
And I went to Harvard, studied art history.
We're
nearby, but
close by, but we didn't really visit each other.
We didn't visit each other.
And close that way.
I became cool at college, and Ted sort of stayed the same, got in less trouble with the police, and so we sort of equalized at that point. Yeah.
And became friends then.
You know, and we matured, so we could rationalize being friends. And then we had to rationalize being in business together, because opportunity knocked and it called for us to, you know, do the Lee Brothers cookbook. And then when that editor at Travel and Leisure called, she wanted the two of us to write about it.
How do you write together? Who does the first draft?
Well, I take odd words and he takes even words.
No, when we're reporting a story, we keep separate notebooks. And then when one of us has time to write the thing, because another one of us is finishing up the other one, you just launch into it, but you've got two notebooks to draw from, like two sort of separate experiences to draw from, and then you launch into it, and let's say I'm the one who gets into it, starts writing. I might only get 200 words into it and sort of get bogged down and wonder if I'm going in the right direction. I might send it back to him, and he might take off from there, but I also might get, you know, 1,800 words into it, and then send it to him to see what he thinks. And so we end up just one of us starts it, and then we end up throwing it back and forth until
five or six or more times, just beefing it up every time, trying to improve it, trying to make the story arc work better.
Editors,
yes.
and
with writing privileges.
Yeah, with writing.
So it's like that, and this happens in the editorial process. Once we turn in our first draft, they may make comments and send it back to us for a revision, or they may start writing themselves, or mostly cutting and trimming. But it's a similar thing to that, so it's not an unusual process, but we just get to develop it a little more intensively before we turn in the first draft.
I envy that. That sounds great.
It works great.
Would you like to have a brother helping you?
I have one, but he lives in California.
Well,
not help me at all.
Bill Smith said we couldn't talk about his book, Seasoned in the South, Recipes from Cook's Corner and Home, but I can. And we can in the context of a wonderful new edition. The paperback edition is out, and there's some more material. Bill, what did you fail to put in the first edition?
Well, oddly, the editors and the publisher said, you need to put in menus. And I said, well, who can't plan their own menu? And apparently nobody can. And everyone says that was a good idea. And so we pulled through some recipes out of it to put menus for holidays and things like that together. And then I had to come up with a few filler items, you know, to plump up those menus. And apparently it was a good idea. I don't know. It didn't occur to me, but that's what.
So modest. We're going to take a quick break. Bill Smith, author of Seasoned in the South, or compiler of the recipes and the wonderful narrative that goes with it, and our visiting with the Lee brothers, Matt Lee and Ted Lee, the authors of the Lee Brothers Southern Cookbook. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bill Smith and I are visiting. We're talking about cookbooks. We're talking with the Lee brothers, Matt Lee and Ted Lee, who are the authors of the Lee Brothers Southern Cookbook. This is a gigantic book, and it's got pictures in it.
A four-pounder.
And it's I love it because the print is generally big enough for me to see and people my age to read happily. And we've been talking generally about Southern cooking, but you guys feel passionately about it. I mean, you all have been called the lard boys, sort of. I mean,
I'll take
you
it.
Really, you're very skinny. What are the most controversial things in the book and in your platform about Southern cooking?
Gosh. That's easy. I mean, it's the Southerners we get in trouble with. A lot of Southerners who view Southern food as on an endless decline from the perfect days way back yonder, whenever they were, and who are upset that we put, smoked paprika into, or put a little bit of lemon zest in something. We do these lusty, really good, rich oxtails, and we pull them from the bone, which will piss off some people because, you should eat them on the bone. But, if we're cooking for mom, we want to pull them off the bone. And then at the very final moment, we brighten it up with just a little bit of fresh ginger and a little bit of lemon zest, just because it's such a hearty, like, base note type of dish, and you want to put another layer in there. But that's the kind of thing that people bridle against.
The people who maybe most criticize you are those who want Southern cooking to be like it was in 1860.
Right.
You'd call them the Amish. With good reason, they want it to stay. But they're not willing to adapt to have the. I mean, every civilization adapts it.
Right. Well, and at the same time, I think we more than many Southern, sort of revivalists are really interested in the origins of it. And we collect old Southern cookbooks avidly. And we, are so interested in the context of like where that recipe came from and what specific county and that sort of thing. But you just have to recognize at a certain point that we've got all these ingredients at our disposal. I mean, lemons are not from here, but they're not exotic anymore. And so why not use them in your cooking if you can? And besides, let's make, Southern food as good as it can be for us, for everyone. There's no reason to circle the wagons around Southern food.
Well, and Bill, does that kind of parallels your philosophy, doesn't it?
Well, I have two clientels. I have one clientele that never wants anything to change, and I have the other half never wants anything to be the same. So I do.
That's beautiful.
So I try to do a little bit of each, but I don't feel like I need to be a museum.
How do you find
either.
That balance?
Right. I don't worry about it anymore. I just do
really?
It.
You just do what you want to do.
Great. I mean, one of your recipes that I particularly love is the honeysuckle sorbet, and that seems to me like, is that something you encountered as a kid, or is it something that you just developed?
My boss made me make that. He said, "Can you make something to eat out of these? They smell so good." It was just something we played with until we got it.
But
right.
That to me seems like such a cool thing. Like,
but it reminds people of when they were young, though. That is interesting because they go, "Oh, this tastes just like it did when I was doing this." With the honeysuckle.
And think of that. I mean, honeysuckle sorbet. It's something that isn't traditional. But it's so Southern. I mean, it's so cool.
Yeah.
Like, what could be
cool? So why shouldn't people are developing new dishes all along? Why should we forget?
You always do it in spite of yourself, really.
Right.
Ice creams are so experimental. We have a chocolate grits ice cream.
Oh, really?
That's what people really get upset about.
I'm going to investigate that soon. I didn't see that yet.
Chocolate grits ice cream. We also have a boiled peanut and sorghum swirl ice cream.
That sounds good.
Classic Southern ingredients, but
what's going
not.
It's going to be ice cream going in those FedEx boxes. Well, but one of the things that I love about Bill Smith and I love about the Lee brothers and others is that it's not just food, for me at least. It's the stories. And that your cookbook is surrounded by stories. Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South, of course, is a storybook as much as it is a recipe book. And it's so much better. The eating experience is so much better if there is a story that goes along with each dish. And some people just don't get that. They think if it just tastes good and if it just is presented well, then everybody's going to like it. When it has the story, I'm into it.
Well, and Southerners know better than others, I think, about storytelling and about entertaining in that way where, you know, throwing a party is really like telling a story and getting everyone involved and making the connections between people and between your place and, you know, the history of your recipe. And then you segue into the food itself and the results are sparkling and fantastic, and you don't even need to say anything anymore. Everyone else is already aware of the story, and it goes on.
Right. Well, what a story. What a great story you guys have brought to us and shared with us, both with your catalog, your wholesale boil peanut catalog, and the stories that are a part of your cookbook and the whole story of how you got there. We thank you for coming to Chapel Hill and sharing it with us. And Bill Smith, thanks, as always,
My pleasure.
Joining us.
Thanks
to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.